Welcome to Turn the Page, the official podcast of the Syosset Public Library.
Hi, this is Jessica with Turn the Page podcast, Syosset Library, and my librarian co-hosts today are
Megan
and Stacey Mencher, Reader Services Librarian.
And we are super excited to have our guests today. Would you like to tell everybody who you are and what you do?
Hi, everybody. My name is Madeline. I work at Lucasfilm. Yes, that Lucasfilm, the creators of Star Wars, and I am our physical archivist. So I take care of our props and costumes. And because we are Star Wars, I also take care of our creatures and droids.
Wow.
That is so cool.
Amazing.
That's really cool. Well, we have, first of all, welcome. We have so many questions for you. So how did you begin working at the archives? Do you have an MLS or something like that?
Yes. So I used to be a high school history teacher, actually, in Brooklyn, New York. I studied a lot of U.S. history, but my favorite thing was always U.S. pop culture history, film history. When I was a teacher, I actually started going to library school. I went to actually Long Island University, so not terribly far away.
High five, Stacey and myself went to Long Island University.
Nice. Well, I did a program. I actually found it because I found a program at NYU that was a joint dual degree program. So it was meant for kind of like subject area specialist librarians. And so I did an American Studies. I found it because I was looking for an American Studies graduate program. So I did an American Studies graduate degree through NYU, and then they partnered with Long Island University for the library science portion. And so I did earn a MLIS. The cool part was that all my classes were actually in the NYU library.
At Bobst Library,
yes, in Washington Square Park. So I was able to take all my classes there, but I also had a library mentor at NYU in a Labor and the Left library. It's called the Tamamint Library. It's on the 10th floor of Bobst Library. And I was able to actually start working there during grad school as well. So I took a quote unquote leave of absence from teaching for a year that turned into forever. But basically I did library science because I thought it was kind of a way to extend being an educator of sorts. And since I was already a teacher, I wanted to do something besides just education for a graduate degree, and that library science kind of led naturally in from that. While I was doing my library degree, I found an internship, which also turned into a very part-time job at the Jim Henson Company, which was what started my entertainment archivist journey, I guess. While I was at Henson, my boss there, Karen Falk, she knew somebody at Lucasfilm. And so I was able to join Lucasfilm for a summer as a Jedi Academy intern in the film archive. It was the archive full of all the physical media. So I spent a lot of time cataloging. I learned all about identifying different forms of media, many of which are very difficult to actually have. It's very difficult to find equipment for playback functionality for a lot of that media. That was really interesting to learn about. And then I went back to New York for a semester, and then Lucasfilm had an opening. So I went back to California in 2012. In 2012, I worked in the film archive for a couple of years. And then at that time, Lucasfilm was sold to Disney. So I ended up being a new Lucasfilm Disney employee for about a year. But during that time, I helped out on a book project with the other part of the collection, which was the props and costumes from the George era of Lucasfilm. And so I learned how to dress mannequins. I learned a lot about staging objects for display or photographs. And so that team, which is now the Lucas Museum of Narrative Art, George's old archive collection is now all part of that museum. I actually joined that team for a while and helped prepare an exhibition for the Smithsonian, which was a Star Wars costume exhibition. And worked with a bunch of other objects from that collection. So that was about 2.5 years or so. And then new Lucasfilm under Disney had started making features again. And so from there, they were looking for someone to start taking care of objects from all the newer films. So basically from 2015's The Force Awakens and forward. And so I that became me. So that's what I do now. I take care of props and costumes. It's been about close to 5 years now working with the new films. Long story short.
I do actually have a question about some of the preservation methods and what you are doing to kind of catalog into the 21st century, like if anything is older, like are you using any digitization efforts and how are you preserving items in the collection?
It's interesting. I've seen this in many different ways because of the fact that I worked with the old collection and now I work with the new collection. So the new collection has kind of this interesting proactive approach to it that involves more than just my physical team. While our objects are being used in a production, so Mandalorian, new show that's on Disney Plus, everyone's probably heard of, during the course of that production, people who are creating licensed products, toys, people who need reference for integrating characters digitally, be it into the actual show itself or for video games or other types of entities, there's actually teams that work alongside our sets to actually capture digital scans, photography while the show is running. Because if you were to wait until the show was done and then do all of that, it might be too late to have, for instance, toys that release with the date of the show or something like that. So there's actually a lot of work done before anything ever actually would ever get into my hands. And then in terms of thinking about preservation longer term for the physical objects themselves, that is very much a case by case basis. There's certain materials over time that have a tendency to die sooner. anything that was made to move and be really malleable on set is probably something that's most likely to deteriorate quicker. So things like puppets, things that are made out of foam latex or silicone, something like that, those items are something that we tend to keep an eye out earlier to figure out what to do with. So in some instances, the best solve is to sort of like freeze something in place so that it no longer maybe functions as a puppet, but it would still kind of look and represent the character. So each thing is very case by case. I would say that the collection I work with right now, because of the fact that it's still so new, most things in it are, you know, 5, 6, 7 years old at the oldest at this point. So it's kind of unique to be able to be with a collection this early in order to first of all, to already see patterns for different types of things that are being used. And then also to sort of have an early hand on being able to, having seen the old collection, now know how to handle the newer items.
Oh, thank you. That sounds so interesting. Is there any kind of specific protective gear that you have to use for some of the items or any kind of technology specifically?
That's a good question. Again, because some of our stuff is so new, it's some of it's still actually being used. So we have a lot of items that get reused for multiple shows. I would say that, let's see, the biggest thing in terms of something that's clay or something that's different types of plastics, a temperature controlled environment is probably your best preventative measure in terms of just making it last longer. The thing that I find interesting, but also it's sad, but interesting, is that a lot of these things are destined to turn to dust. I like to say they're going to return to the Force one day because they really aren't built to last, but our job is just to keep them visible for people as long as possible, knowing that it is not going to be forever. But basically a temperature controlled environment for some of these things will prolong that. Other things that I look out for that are trickier, but that we try to take care of sooner with different types of solvents if possible, or sending them to conservators, is a lot of times when you're on a set and there's something broke or something's, you know, torn really quickly and you're fixing it with tape or with, you know, carpet tape is a big one because it's double-sided. So for something like trooper armor that just needs to be held into place really quickly, I would say that residue is something that I spend a decent amount of time trying to figure out what would be the best solvents in order to remove it safely, but not damage or strip away anything on the original piece.
That's fascinating. And in a way, you're preserving it as a force ghost. So even though it will return to the force, it will come back more powerful than. So in other words, it's probably pretty chilly in the area where you work.
Yeah, we try to keep it temperature controlled. I'd say that the thing on our side is almost more than anything is, you know, we have specific areas where no one else but us are allowed to go in. So it prevents movement. We are there anytime any objects are ever moved from different sites. So for instance, if we're going to do an exhibition, our team is the one that packs up the items and then we receive it on the other end and no one ever touches them without our presence. So just by having just kind of oversight on that helps to prevent things over time from happening.
So how are items cataloged and are there like cross subheadings? I'm thinking like in the world of like public libraries, you know, like if you're looking for an author, but an author has an alias, you know, you kind of go in and the catalog will pull the author up from an alias. And does this make any sense? Or is this like, am I just doing public library stuff?
No, public library. I mean, here's the thing. That's the kind of thing that we aspire to. Information professionals who are part of taking something that was created for a very different purpose and then giving it data and catalog records that will outlive the films they won't outlive the films, but that will become useful for things beyond just having been filmed in this feature or this TV show. Basically happening is we inherit data generated by these productions. And then from there, we need to re-decipher it or reinterpret it for other needs. So, let's see, what would be a good example of this? Okay, here's a great example. So when new creatures are created for Star Wars films, a lot of times the species name may not have been identified yet. A character may not have been identified yet. It may be that we don't know what the final edit of the film will look like, and therefore a creature might become more prominent than initially thought. So at that point, when it's clear that that creature might have a big interaction with a main human character, then it may get a name, a species name, and a bit of a backstory. But while the movie's being made, that information isn't available because it doesn't exist yet. And so the creatures get basically like an identification number. So you know across the course of filming, like this creature number, it lives in this box, here's all the components, and it was in these scenes. But it might not get a name till later. So I might get a record for this creature that I can visibly identify. And later after the film has come out, and maybe, you know, a lot of our books have visual dictionaries that come out with them as well to reintroduce or introduce new characters, things like that. So at that point, I can look at the data and say, oh, cool, that has a name now. You know, that creature didn't have a name throughout the course of production, but now it has a name. So I need to update that and find the records for it and make sure that that piece of information is included. Another good example is code names. So we might use a code name for something over the course of filming. And then once the movie's out and everyone knows and this and that, then we can put, you know, that so-and-so made a cameo in this film. Not trying to spoil anything for Star Wars fans, but So yes, there is some reinterpreting of data. There is some adding of data in order to make that accessible. There's also things like there's very common misspellings in the Star Wars universe. There's people referring to characters in a certain way. Here's a good one, like C-3PO. It's C-3P letter O. Some records might just not have that dash. So when you search for them, that doesn't come up. So it's anticipating the needs of who's going to be looking for this information and making sure it's as consistent as possible.
That's a fabulous answer. And that very much reminds me of, you know, like sometimes when you're searching for something in a public library and it's not coming up, and then you find it and you're just like, wait a second, that's what that was called? Okay.
Totally. We had a really good, incident, but all of our five features that we have made since I became part of this newer galaxy, they've all been made in England. And so that's another layer of translation to be made, which is that sometimes clothing items have different names in the Queen's English versus American English. So we also need to make sure that both teams, both sides are able to search for things how they identify them. That's definitely a big thing that I noticed. There's also, we had a misspelling that was, it was many layers of confusion before we figured out what it meant. But basically, if you think about like bench seating at a diner, like banquette seating, you know, like that word.
Yeah.
So in British English, somebody called it banquette because of British pronunciation, and they spelled it in the database B-O-N-K-E-T. And it many, many layers of confusion to figure out what that referred to. And now we know. And that is one of our main kind of reminders of how to suss through information and make sure that we're clearing it up and clarifying it as best as we can.
I've like three questions, but I'll start with my first one. So like, how many people are on your team specifically that you work with?
So here in the US, there's typically three of us. And then we have some folks in the UK, usually 2 to 3 people in the UK who've been there because of the fact that that's where we've shot our films. But I'm part of a team that's called Physical Asset Management. And so on every TV show or film that we have, we also have an assigned physical asset coordinator whose job it is to oversee data ingested from that specific TV show or film to make sure that all of the props and costumes and other creatures, set dressing and anything gets documented. So that part is actually from a very, very much like a financial perspective in terms of tracking financial ledgers when purchases are made and translating that into, okay, they bought 18 bolts of wool fabric. Okay, well that became, you know, 18 Jawa robes or something like that. So it's kind of on that level. So in terms of our United States corporate team, there's three of us typically, but there's a lot of people attached to each of our productions as well.
That's really cool. Because I first thought it was just you, and I was like, oh my God, you do so much. You need to like clone yourself. And so the archives, like, is that just more like in-house of like with Lucasfilms and all of that? Or do you ever open to the public for anything? Or is it just like when you work with exhibitions?
So yeah, it's meant for internal research and reference. There's any research or reference that is done with any of our assets by someone that's not an actual Disney or Lucasfilm employee is typically someone that is in some form of contract one way or another with a Lucasfilm or Disney entity. So publishing, if there's a book project that requires, let's say, some new photography of some items, but it needs to be a Lucasfilm sanctioned project. Same with licensed products. If a company wants to recreate either like a prop replica of some kind, or if they want to create small figures, but that need to look pretty close, then that's all cleared and already sort of like a expectation for our franchise, because people love Star Wars so much. But it does have to be cleared in that way. There isn't like a there is not like a public tour or any sort of like public access point. We do have convention appearances on the regular. So typically in non-COVID times, we typically have some form of a display at San Diego Comic-Con, for instance. We do that there's always some form of a Lucasfilm presence, and usually there's some form of prop, costume, or creature or something from our actual productions. We also do a lot of events that help promote upcoming projects. So since the time I've started, we've done displays and actually had live walk arounds with real costumes for red carpet premieres for all of our films. And even sometimes for the Mandalorian, there were some small events as well. So so those are the opportunities where people besides us actually get to see items, which is really fun. There's other conventions we've done in the past as well. We did New York Comic Con. We've done Essence Fest in New Orleans a couple of different times. It's great. It's really fun to see people get excited.
Stacey, there you go, Stacey. There's your entry for this.
That's the greatest segue into my next question, because I'm no longer part of, just because I haven't paid my dues. So what year is it? It's 2021. So 2029, I went to-
Wait, 2029, you were in the future?
2020, the future, 2019, whatever. You get my point. I'm too excited. But in 2019, I went with my husband, we went down to New Orleans, and I was like, you know, we like New Orleans, we like nerd stuff. So we ended up joining the intergalactic crew of Chewbacca's, which is the nerd core Bacchanalian revelry, all obsessed with anything, but mostly Star Wars. And I was going to say, like, have they, like, I'm sure probably someone from them, because there's like a bajillion of them, been like, oh my God, Lucasfilms, because I just think of everything because I see the giant fluffy pink Chewbacca's like all the time now.
Oh yeah.
Of like working with stuff like that. But it's cool because you brought up New York Comic Con. Like, I know we've been in the past.
Stacey and I have COVID definitely time. Walked by one of your displays at New York Comic Con.
Yeah, well, there is a lot of interesting, this is like more of like a general Lucasfilm kind of way of life, I guess, is that there's a huge fan community. There's a lot of different fan groups. Mm-hmm. And over the course of the time I've been in this job, we have a lot of interactions with fan groups, people who come visit us at booths. Occasionally fans are asked, this is not necessarily my jurisdiction, but fans are able to actually join in shoots because they look for people with their own armor, for instance. Live events, occasionally you'll see people dressed up in costumes, and sometimes those are fan groups as well. Some of them
we've worked with a bunch of them here. We've worked with the droid builders. We've worked with I'm drawing a blank on all of their names.
There's the 501st Legion.
The 501st. Yeah, I was going to say 501st. And also the Saber Leagues, I think.
There's a Saber League, and there's also the Rebel Legion, which
we have not worked with them specifically, but I do know that the 501st sometimes crosses over with them, which one would think that that's like an impurity, but it's really not. You could, you know,
I mean, have your costume. It's partly just because of breadth of characters, but also something that we kind of think about at Lucasfilm is that when there's fan groups that are appearing, a lot of times it's characters that you don't see their faces. So it's just, you know, a stormtrooper or even a Darth Vader or a Kylo Ren or something that you don't see their face, because then there's no casting confusion. Whereas a lot of the Rebel Legion characters, a lot of them are face characters. So there's people who definitely, this is their job and this is their specialty. I just happen to have a sideline view because of the fact that we do occasionally provide screen used costumes for characters that are harder to find. So on the red carpet for The Last Jedi, we had some Praetorian guards, which are the red guards that were in Snoke's throne room. that look sort of samurai-esque. So those, there were no fans that had that because it was brand new. And so we used some from the film, and we had costumers come and dress characters. So let's say that's a little bit of something that isn't a typical archivist position, but I'm part of a larger team that supports all of those kinds of uses of our assets. So we oversee their use. We make sure we have proper crew. And then we also document and make sure the condition has been, has remained consistent over the course of using the objects.
That's very much, I think, like, as a librarian, you know, you go in and you train to do something, but you do often find that your job ends up stretching in ways you wouldn't have expected. So, I mean, I know that all three of us here can relate to something that was definitely not what we would have considered in the job description. However, none of us were with those awesome costumes, because those were so beautiful. But I think we've all happily worked out of job description from time to time. For instance, podcasting. Did any of us think we would be doing this when we went to library school?
No, but also going on, because I did school around the same time you did at LAU Medlin, because I had classes also in the city. But the stuff that you end up doing, or what you think you're going to go into and then ends up being a little bit, ends up being really cool and fun to do. And like, just some of the stuff you say you do, I'm like, that sounds so cool. Like,
well, thank you. Yeah, it definitely wasn't what I expected. Again, I do want to say that in a larger studio setting, it may not be quite like this. I'm the only physical asset archivist at Lucasfilm, but we do have, side note, we have people who focus on photography, people who focus on film. But in a different studio setting, I wouldn't typically be involved with this, but Lucasfilm is, in this case, we're small and lean. So I am part of a team that supports this. So I will make sure that I'm there to do everything that's necessary for it.
So a question that kind of goes back to what we were talking about earlier about reference questions. So do you get many reference questions, and how does it work if somebody needs to see an artifact for a project?
So sometimes there's reference questions we can answer. Sometimes it's for other Lucasfilm groups. So we work very closely with our digital asset team. And sometimes they'll have a question like, Madeline, we have all these amazing photographs of Rey's newest lightsaber, but we don't know how long it is. Can you, like, do you have that information? And so that's something where I might be able to just go take another photo for them with a measuring tape next to it, so they can add that photo to their library. So then as people look through, they can say, oh, great, sense of scale. Excellent, got it. Other times it might need to be more exact. And so I'll just provide more information if possible. So that's a good example of just sort of a typical reference question we might get. But then when it comes to in-depth research that is needed to be done, we have a whole protocol in place where, for instance, if it's someone coming to do research for a licensed product, we have our consumer products representative from Lucasfilm who facilitates that. They come to us and say, our licensee would like to research, you know, this lightsaber. We can say whether we have it with us right now or whether it's still being used on a show, so they know where it is. Then let's assume we have it in San Francisco in our offices. They will arrange a visit with that licensee. So that person or group will come. They will bring their equipment. Some of them will bring 3D scanning equipment. Some of them will do their own photography setup. They have light boxes. They bring Pantones. I mean, it's like a very involved process. And so then they will come. They'll basically set up shop. We have a workspace that we keep open and malleable for all different purposes. So whether it's photo shoots, whether it's someone needs to do an interview of someone and they need an extra space, and we can set up a couple of mannequins behind them. If we are dressing mannequins for exhibition, we have space. And then if we're packing things up and we need to bring crates and trunks and boxes and all kinds of things in, we do that too. So the licensing folks, the consumer products folks, will bring in these, like, we call them licensees. They are the people that are officially sanctioned to build officially sanctioned props or clothing or things like that. And then they come in and, you know, we provide gloves, but at this point they know us pretty well and they've usually brought their own gloves. And then we're there at all times with them when they're researching the items. And then if there's anything that they need from us, we can help them on the spot. If there's any questions they have, we can help with that. And that's what we do to give them access. So.
Megan, did you want to take a question?
Yeah, very cool. I actually had a question about the use of audio animatronics in terms of like now that we're using digital representations of characters, do you find that you still have in the collection audio animatronics that are used regularly for the films and TV? And how does that compare to the digital efforts? How are they preserved like differently?
Yeah, that's a great question. So we have, so audio animatronics is like very much like a Disney attractions type of terminology.
Yes.
And there are some Star Wars characters that they have built using like our character stylings into that. Our creatures and characters that are built similarly, they are typically either, instead of being like, if you think about an audio animatronic when you're riding an attraction, those are 100% mechanical and they are programmed and they, you know, they do things in tune with whatever the attraction is. On the flip side of that, our creatures and characters like that are either radio controlled in some way, or they're actually puppeteered or characters that people are wearing. So they're not necessarily 100% standalone, you know, someone behind a curtain and the creature can kind of go and do everything. It's much more manual than that. And that is also because that gives more directorial freedom so that, you know, oh, we want BB-8 to run this way instead of this way. Okay, well, we got to pull out the right side BB-8 instead of the left side BB-8. So go get the other puppet and we'll make it work. You know, like there's very, lot of, they're ready for anything basically is what's going into people's minds when they're building and operating these different characters and creatures. It's very cool. Those are some of the pieces that are challenging when it comes to preserving because of the materials made. So while an infrastructure or mechanical, hydraulic or radio controlled internal guts might physically outlast things, it's also a matter of what software is going into running them. And then on the outside, it's the foam latex or other materials that were meant to move that over time, you know, will start deteriorating. So it's just, again, like figuring out which things to prioritize over time and what to do with that.
That's so interesting.
I actually have a question, but it relates to Megan's question because Megan is a huge Disney fan I know, can't wait to get back there. Did you all at the Lucasfilm Archives have, did you work to create Galaxy's Edge at all? Were you like getting up in there and kind of, let me rephrase that. Did you, you know, was there a lot of reference going on there when they were trying to build this world to immerse you into the Star Wars universe as much as possible? Because I know so many people who are probably listening and so many of us here are just dying to go and see it with our families when COVID lifts.
So my team and various other people involved at Lucasfilm, we spent a great deal of time working on Galaxy's Edge. In terms of what our physical asset team was able to help with is we actually provided a lot of original molds so that items could be recreated from those exact molds. Things like helmets, C-3PO parts, for instance, is a big one. Those are types of things that we were able to provide. We also were able to provide a lot of physical samples. So things like texture, things like color, other materials that we sort of regularly appear in Star Wars, we were able to provide for. Our digital asset team provided a lot of visual reference, but our physical asset team also provided things like helmets that were unpainted so that they could be repainted to suit the environment and made to look aged the way they wanted to have them look to match the environment, for instance. Yeah, there was quite a bit over time that we helped out with. Yes, and that was really, it was really fun that it was going to go into something that so many people treasure. Yeah, it's really fun to have helped out with Galaxy's Edge because I too love Disney. I love going to Disneyland here. I grew up in the Midwest, so I grew up going to Disney World, Walt Disney World a lot, and I love it. So it's been great fun to be able to go, and it's a lot of fun that, it was a lot of fun to go there and point at things and say, hey, we helped out with that. That's so cool. So
have you always been a Star Wars fan or fans of Lucas properties?
I grew up with Star Wars, absolutely. I would say that my approach has always been kind of more about the thing than to be a fan of the thing itself, if that makes sense. So like, yeah. I love the fact that Star Wars gets referenced in so many other pieces of pop culture. I love learning about the history of the technology that's gone into things like Star Wars over time. I love learning about the ways that model makers used to build miniatures. I love learning how things have changed over time into what our CGI world looks like. I definitely have always had a love for that kind of history. In terms of Star Wars as like a thing to consume and a bunch of films to watch, I definitely like a lot of people, I grew up watching the original trilogy of Star Wars. My family was very, really enjoyed it. My parents went on their honeymoon in 1979 in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan and randomly found an R2-D2 ceramic cookie jar in a copper shop because Upper Peninsula was a big copper mining place for a long time. And so they had this like story about the woman who worked there who was asking them to barter basically. And they were like, we just want to buy it. Can you just tell us how much it is? And it was just this whole story that I've heard like 100 times. My whole life, our cookie jar was R2-D2. And it was a very early licensed product. It says Fox 1977 underneath it. Fox produced the very first Star Wars film, Fox Studios. And yeah, I have dibs on that. I told my brothers, I have dibs on that. but also around the time that the special editions came out, which was 1997, when the films were re-released in theaters, my little brother was pretty young and he was very interested in Star Wars at the time. And he could barely talk when he was like a couple years before that, when he was like two, he could barely talk, but one of his first words was Dawal. So yeah, Star Wars has always been important in terms of something that brings our family together. My other brother is turning 35 next month and he's gonna have a Baby Yoda themed birthday party. So
that's amazing.
And by birthday
party, that's awesome.
On Zoom with my parents and me zooming in. But
Baby Yoda was my kids' favorite holiday gift this year, this winter. Like that's what they wanted. And they really took, I mean, first of all, that was beautifully done. So I'm sure that your team had something to do with that, people making, the Baby Yoda toy that everybody wanted this year, as authentic as possible.
We, our consumer products team definitely took care of that. By the time that the child was to the world, the digital asset team had really taken care of how to give reference to everyone, because he was in such high demand. So
yeah, my kids, I mean, they really take it seriously, taking care of the child. Has his nap.
That's adorable.
It's very, yes. Well, they've also been in quarantine for a year. So, that was the only, the only child-to-child interaction they're getting right now. Yeah, a little sad.
So do you have a preference of Jedi or Sith? If you had like a lightsaber, do you know what color yours would be?
I think out of the Jedi Sith debate, really, I'm more just rebel, I think. Like, I don't think I'm a Jedi or a Sith. I think I'm just like I think in my mind, I'm a rebel pilot or something. that's what I imagine. That's where I would be probably. But if I had to have a Star Wars, if I had to have a lightsaber blade, it would probably be magenta. That's my favorite color, one of my favorite colors.
I feel you on that, because that's also one of my colors.
I like teal, and I know that there's like, you know, like if you, there's probably, I mean, there's as many lightsabers as there are colors, like lightsaber colors as there are colors. I think looking through lightsaber lore, though, as flashy and cool as it would be to have a teal colored lightsaber, I think yellow probably fits my personality the most. And I believe the librarian of the Jedi had a yellow lightsaber. If I recall, I have
to. Jocasta Nu.
Yes, Jocasta Nu. Right. Yes, had a yellow lightsaber. So anyway.
Do you have a favorite item in the collection?
You know, I think it's more like a general concept of favorite things. I grew up watching Sesame Street. So along with liking Star Wars and other sort of imagined things, but I really loved puppets in terms of Sesame Street characters. I cannot tell you how many episodes of The Muppet Show I've watched since The Muppet Show dropped on Disney Plus last Friday. Friday, the 19th of February, 2021.
Yes.
I think that when I see things like Yoda puppets or other puppet creatures, they make me really happy because it's kind of, first of all, it's just fun to see different techniques and how things are different between something like a felt hand puppet that is very minimalist in terms of design and functionality into something that's really complex and involves a lot of different elements, and then also just materials that are used to create them. So I definitely think that characters like Yoda or Max Rebo, who was part of Jabba's rock band, Jabba's Lair band, and other puppeteered characters. The thing that I think makes Yoda especially special, kind of like as an overall concept of a character, is that for the original trilogy, it was Jim Henson's idea that Frank Oz perform Yoda. And then Yoda's, a lot of times people who worked on films, they're typically freelance. So they work on a film or they work on a show and then they move to different shows. And so there were actually some Henson puppet builders that helped build and perform Yoda as well, besides Frank Oz. And so that connection between those contemporaries, that really, it just makes me really happy to feel that connection and see how that history changes and grows and connects people as well.
Yeah, I love how interconnected all of this is, you know, and as you know, we interviewed Susie at Henson Archives, and that was a really fun interview. It was about a year ago, I believe, as well, right before we closed down the library to the public for a while. You know, I love the interconnectedness of, you know, just like when you look through just certain important milestones of, I guess, like childhood, you know, like people growing up in the late 70s, early 80s, 90s. And I guess now, because now everything is connected to now, because Star Wars is not going anywhere, neither are Muppets or Fraggles, apparently, that they do kind of have this root that sort of grew like a beautiful garden. It, from, you know, this same place, you look at certain programming as a child, and Steven Spielberg had a hand in a lot of it, even if you don't realize it, and yeah. George Lucas and Jim Henson. So you really just find these little threads everywhere you go, and it's just so, it's very comforting. It's almost like it's like the chocolate chip cookies of childhood pop culture. Sort of realizing everything is connected. I mean, I know I'm like a huge dork, and when I used to watch Batman the Animated Series, I cried when I found out that Mark Hamill voiced the Joker, because he's Luke Skywalker and he played a villain so well. And there was just something so emotional in that. So yeah, I know I'm just completely a huge dork. So there you go.
I have one more question, because it relates to what you said about when helping out with building like the Galaxy Edge thing. So when there's like a film or TV show or something, do you ever get like actors or production people in, or even writers, to be like, oh, can we, you know, see one of the artifacts or like feel it to get a way to describe it, or how any of the writers or actors or people would know what they're dealing with or something like that?
You know, it goes the other direction. So typically they would write things first, then the prop makers or costumers would start to create, or at least start sketching, and then get feedback through that channel. So that all happens well before I'll ever see an artifact. What has happened before, especially when they were first starting up for The Force Awakens, so the first, you know, the first Star Wars film in 10 years being made, that some of the production people did come to the archive to look at things and get a little bit of a sense of some of the older artifacts into the Lucas Museum archives. But yes, there are moments where people do want to get an overall sense of what types of things have come before, and then go from there in terms of the creative process towards the sketches and drawings and schematics, and then manufacturing and creation.
Well, this was so cool, and it's really just so interesting and informative to hear about this type of work, because, you know, as public librarians, it shows a different piece of what we do, or rather what other paths master's in library science can take. And for just people who are interested in pop culture and the inner workings of stuff, it's a really nice little look behind the curtain. So thanks so much, Madeline.
Thank you.
Thank you for what you do.
Thank you for having me, all of you. It's really nice to talk to you.
And high five again for Long Island University. All right. So once again, this was Jessica,
Megan,
and Stacy,
and
Madeline from Lucasfilm.
And we are going to close this chapter of Turn the Page.
It's time to close this chapter of Turn the Page. Join us for the next episode. Thank you.